Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, November 14th. The grand old party, the GOP, made great gains nationally and locally this election. We take a closer look at the dynamics shaping up at the state legislature. We check in on the latest with the housing situation on Maui. Hopefully more families displaced by the wildfires will be in new digs for the holidays. We learn about the nearly forgotten voyage from San Francisco to Tahiti 100 years ago on a yacht called the Ka'imiloa. And as we mark the 150th birthday of King David Kalakaua, we learn about his last trip to San Diego, California. You're back with The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Trump factor certainly helped to boost the number of Republican lawmakers in the Hawaii State Legislature. Here to take a closer look at how the pendulum is swinging more red here in Hawaii is HPR reporter Ashley Mizuo. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so the numbers are getting up there.
Yeah, I think for Republicans, they felt like the 2024 election and locally and nationally, it was kind of like a watershed moment for them. You know, even in Hawaii, that people consider to be very, very blue, Trump has made, you know, some considerable gains here. In 2016, he was at 29% of the vote, and in 2024, he's up to 37% here. And, you know, Republicans were able to pick up 3 seats in the House, 1 seat in the Senate, and all the Republican incumbents retained their positions, although, you know, during election season, people thought that they would be vulnerable, but in the end, most of them easily kept their seats. And so that brings the number of Republicans in the House up from 6 to 9 and 2 to 3 in the Senate. And, you know, most of those gains did come from leeward Oahu. I talked to Sharon Kinsaat, a sociology professor at Grinnell College, who has been working on a study about Filipino conservatives. And she spent time in Hawaii interviewing people and observing Diamond Garcia's campaign in District 42, that's Kapolei area, against Democrat Anthony McKenna Paris. And, you know, the main issues that she said most people were concerned about were high cost of living and housing. And they just felt like the Democrats in Hawaii have not been able to address it. And she told me that one woman she interviewed who voted for President Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012 has voted for Trump since 2016 and locally has been voting for Republicans.
And she told me, like, oh, Sharon, is it racist if I'm just like thinking of how I will not lose my house for now? She said, I really don't like it that they automatically blame me or call me like that, like if I'm just saying that I just want my needs to be met first. And so she was the one I referenced about, oh, so I'm just going to vote Republican to stick it to them, to all of the people who have called me like racist just because I'm talking about my concern right now and my suffering. Like that is, of course, a product of whatever economic policies. So those kinds of things, I think the reaction of people, and this, of course, occurs in a highly polarized environment.
And, you know, Diamond Garcia's campaign was centered on eliminating income tax and eliminating significant portions of the general excise taxes on groceries and medicine. And, you know, I was watching some videos from when he was campaigning, and they did a town hall with Civil Beat, him and his opponent, Anthony McKenna Paris, the Democrat. And, you know, every time Garcia spoke, he was met, you know, with kind of a roaring applause by the people within the town hall. Because he continuously hit on this topic of eliminating income tax, eliminating significant portions of general excise tax, putting money back into people's pockets. Of course, he was light on the details on, you know, how revenue would then be replaced if you eliminate these major income resources. And, you know, we're going to see that be an issue at the legislature this year with next session, as they hastily made this massive income tax cut last session and are kind of scrambling to find ways to replace that revenue. But, you know, Representative Garcia puts the blame of high taxes and cost of living on Democrats, which have held a supermajority in the state for years. And, you know, I spoke with Ryan Mendondo, a school leader at Dreamhouse Eva Beach Public Charter School, and he says it's the same sentiment he hears from parents and community members.
It's really the sentiment of no one in government is helping Indigenous people, or no one in government is helping Native Hawaiian communities. But the person that I know and trust is voting for blank because they think they're going to give money to Hawaiians, or they're going to give us more opportunities to buy a house, or there'll be overall more money in my pocket so I can buy food for my family, right?
Yeah. And we've been hearing that from the Republicans, but this time it's really resonating, I guess.
Yeah, and I think, too, it's about having, you know, kind of a clear message. When you look at Senator Samantha Decourt's campaign on the west side of Oahu, she was against Representative Cedric Gates, the Democrat. And you look at her campaign, and you can distill it down to kind of one concept, housing Native Hawaiians, period. You read her story, and it's clear. And you kind of look at, you know, Representative Cedric Gates' website, and it has lots of policy explanations about different ways you can do tax credits, tax cuts. But I think people are looking for, you know, that short distilled story where you really get the idea that this is going to impact you, you know, personally. And I think the concept of putting trust in your community is another way that Republicans have been able to make gains in these areas. Kinsa'at pointed to the power of churches that are in favor of more conservative policies, but they are also often the entities in the area that are providing resources like daycare or English language assistance for Filipino immigrants that come to Hawaii.
Your social network is the church, and you really like put your trust in that church. So come election time, whatever it is that their pastor or everyone else talks about in the church, of course, like you already believe, because that is already your community since you arrived here as an immigrant.
And, you know, Mondando says if Democrats want to make progress in the area, they need to build those types of communities on West Oahu. Mondando, who is a Democrat, says he can't point to, you know, clear spaces in West Oahu where other progressives can talk about their ideas and gather. But he says it's also about meeting people where they're at with the type of language you're using and how Democrats can talk about core issues.
This happened 2 years ago. Our students want a grant to talk about LGBTQ issues and support families in them. When we labeled it as a LGBTQ awareness training, major pushback. When we switched it to Mahu education, large crowd, large understanding. We were talking about the same thing, but Mahu education was cultural based. It was something that they understood. Like, if we're going to talk about epidemics, but if we're going to talk about Native Hawaiian health and well-being, everyone will be here. And so I think there is a disconnect in the messaging of what is authentically Hawaiian and how I feel invited into those conversations.
And so I think it really comes down to two things in this election, and it's something that we've heard at like a local level. I mean, both locally and nationally, where Republicans just did a better job of conveying how people are hurting and simple, clear ways to directly help individual people. You know, maybe debating whether or not those policies that they're talking about are actually going to do that. Regardless of that, I think their message was just a lot clearer and really spoke to people who really are struggling to get by in these areas and are facing incredibly difficult, you know, high cost of living, traffic, things that, you know, affect people day to day. And, you know, they've just been able to better articulate that in West Oahu and build those communities way before election day. You hear about the churches, you know, that trust starts years before they even start thinking about elections. And so I think that's one point. And the other one is, you know, they have been able to build those places on the west side to gather and talk about issues that, you know, they aren't inherently political in the church, but, you know, they can have political kind of connotations or orientations.
Overtones.
And they have built a community of trust through churches and religion in that area that, you know, Democrats and progressives just have not been able to do.
It's just interesting to see the numbers, you know, start to climb up again. You know, I'd mentioned earlier, you know, as we were chatting, that back in the day when I covered the legislature, you know, it was double digits in the House. I'm trying to remember, like 14 or, you know, but it was up there. And then it drop down drastically, but it's interesting to see the climb. And then you've got the three seats in the Senate as well.
Yeah, and you already see kind of the effects of that where, you know, last year during session, Senator Brent Awa and Senator Kurt Favela were unable to establish, you know, even a minority leader. And
right, so they didn't get along.
And immediately after, you know, this election, they've been able to coalesce and they're setting up their research department. And so, you know, I think that we're going to see the legislature next year is just going to be a whole different ballgame.
Right, but at least you've got maybe more of the two-party system were yeah, before I think it was yeah. the supermajority. Yeah. But thank you so much, Ashley. We've been talking to HPR's government reporter, Ashley Mizzouo. She's been taking a closer look at the election winners and losers. There's a bright spot on the horizon for some of the families displaced by the Maui wildfires. Here to talk about that is HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
So I understand there may be some families moving into some new housing?
Yeah, so there's some developments in FEMA housing coming up. And I spoke with Bob Fenton, who's the regional administrator for FEMA, to get some of those updates. And Kilohana is a modular housing site for fire survivors in Lahaina. And the first move-ins are coming in expected on November 22nd. So that's coming right up. He said the infrastructure is in at the site. The roads are in, the sidewalks are in, and they've been working on moving the housing units in there. They have a variety of sizes, one-bedroom, two-bedroom, three-bedroom homes. He said there's about 50 housing units that are there already, soon to be ready to go. And by the end, they will have 167 units that are expected to be all completed sometime in January.
I'm so excited for them because, you know, they'll be in new digs for the holidays.
Yes, hopefully that'll be the case, at least for some of those families. And one of my questions was, how will folks be selected for this housing? So Fenton explains.
We're going to start off with those that are still in our direct sheltering, meaning that they're in some type of hoteling unit and we haven't been able to place them in direct lease into a condo complex. And so that will be the first group. And we have a little bit over 30 different families or households in that category. And the next thing we want to do is really move homeowners into direct lease because we know that they will be the longest in temporary housing as they go to rebuild. There are some homeowners that are already starting to rebuild. And in some cases where we could place a unit on their property and there's sufficient space, we're looking at that as an alternative. So there's 13 homes that we are looking at to potentially place a temporary unit on their property. And then the third priority would be first responders and teachers that are in our direct housing program. And then next priority would be those households with children in schools, especially on the west side that are in our direct housing program, and those that have access and functional needs. A number of our units are set aside for those that have access and functional needs. And then our last priority is those the furthest away from Lahaina. So those that we originally put into direct leases in Central Maui or Pihei, and to get them closer, we're working with those that would want to move back to the west side.
It's just hard to imagine that there are still families in some hotels.
It is, yeah. 30 families, he estimated, are still in hotels. So that's been a long haul for them and hopefully nearing the end of that hotel journey for those folks. There are two different programs that they are putting tiny homes on private properties. As he mentioned, there are about 13 lots which homeowners could live in a tiny home unit on their own property while their home is being rebuilt. And they're also looking for owners of second home properties in Lahaina who don't plan to rebuild in the next few years. Fenton said they're working with the county and have identified about 175 lots, and they're seeing if those owners are interested in leasing their land to FEMA to place one or two tiny homes, again, as another interim housing option for folks. Another change coming up for fire survivors in FEMA's housing programs is a change in pricing coming up. And so Fenton talks about that here.
You know, the biggest thing is in February, we hit the 18-month mark for our direct housing program. You know, typically it's an 18-month program. I extended it for a year. So it's been extended from February 2025 for up to another year as needed for individuals. One of the things that happens, though, is at the end of the 18-month mark, which is February, we're required to start charging them rent. And so we will be working with them to start discussing the rental process. Everyone, the 1,200 plus households, are getting notices from us right now about the need to provide rent. We will obviously look at their financial situation and assessing that. It never goes past 100% of fair market rental rate. And what we can do is adjust it downward from there. We want to ensure that no individual pays more than 30% of their income, as that's kind of the number for housing is 30% of their income.
Yeah. So you do hope that, you know, by now that they would have gotten back in their jobs or found new jobs and have some type of income coming in.
That is a hope. I know that change is causing a lot of anxiety for fire survivors right now. So hopefully they'll be able to, you know, find something that is within their budget and doable for them moving forward. That applies to the direct lease rental program as well as the new Kilohana unit that we heard about a minute ago. And so that'll be across the board for all FEMA housing programs. There are an additional 500 households in rental assistance programs through FEMA that provides 175% of fair market rate when they're leasing their own units. So those aren't units provided directly through FEMA. They went out and got their own rentals. And so FEMA is helping those folks with rental assistance. So there's a whole variety of programs that FEMA is assisting with. And, you know, as you said, hopefully more folks in housing by the holidays here pretty soon.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel about the situation with housing there in Maui.
Hawaii, there's a special appreciation for things that are local. And we take that seriously at HPR, where 30% of the programs you hear are made in-house by our own team. Everything from Morning Cafe to The Conversation, Bridging the Gap to Evening Jazz. Whether you're a news junkie or a music lover, HPR's local programming keeps you rooted in our shared island community. Learn more about our shows at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Younger workers in Portugal are leaving the country in droves. High rents and low wages are pushing them out. The government introduced new tax breaks to get them to stay, but
to be honest, these measures are coming a little bit too late. If they really want to fix the country, they have a long road ahead.
Brain drain in Portugal, that's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Years ago, a massive yacht called the Ka'imi Loa set off on a historic voyage from San Francisco to Tahiti. During the trip, it became the first vessel to send a clear radio signal across an entire ocean. It was also one of the first hybrid ships using both sails and a diesel engine. Cesar Becerra is a South Florida historian who was working on another project when he got a tip about this little remembered voyage that had lasting impacts on science and technology. Earlier this year, he published a book about it titled The Ka'imi Loa Project. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Becerra in our studio.
1924, 100 years ago, literally to this very week, in Honolulu, the ship that had come from San Francisco, the Ka'imi Loa, docks here, gets a lot of little things finished up, and then takes off on the 9th of November to Hilo. On the 15th, then it takes off on a 2.5-month journey to Tahiti, basically. On board the ship are six scientists from the Bishop Museum that have their own interesting outlook on what they want to do. And there was a contract between the owner of the ship, Med Kellum Sr., and the scientists. But it was kind of, I wouldn't say loosey-goosey, but it had some pockets that weren't really synced up. For example, they would say they would be in consultation with Mr. Kellum as to where the ship would go. Later on, that would chafe a little bit. The scientists wanted to stay a little longer. Mr. Kellum sometimes wanted to go on his fishing expedition. And by the time they get to Tahiti, he actually kicks them off the boat.
Why did Kellum want to go on this voyage?
So Kellum got his start in Key West, Florida, after losing, unfortunately, both his parents. At age 10, he's in Key West in the 1880s, looking at the last vestige of where basically canvas and rope give way to steam and diesel, okay? So you have all these great, beautiful four-masted schooners just sitting there, lying about at lay, as they say, basically on death's door. But he's romanced by it, and he kind of in his mind said, man, one day I would love to set sail on a journey on one of these remarkable boats. Later on in his life, when he has the means to do so, particularly his second marriage, marrying a niece of Andrew Carnegie, he then finds this incredible ship, originally called the Luzon, almost also at death's door after 20 years of hard work taking lumber to the Philippines, buys it and transforms it into the Kaimaloa, with everything you could throw at it, electricity, running water, engines to bring all the sails, etc., you name it, and the capacity to make 250 pounds of ice a day. So all the trimmings. Also on board, he tricks out and funds a massive lab. This is 50 feet long, 8 feet wide, 10 feet tall. The ability to not just take photographs and recordings, but moving film, and not just take it, which that's been done, but show it the very next day on the deck of the ship. So you also have the past coming in, crashing into the future, or you could say the innocence of one era butting up against the technology of today.
The romanticism of it all, and also like the anachronism of these cutting edge technologies aboard this dying breed of a ship.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of going into the future, on the second voyage, the ship now holds the accolade as the first ship to have technology that would send a clear signal across an entire ocean. That had never been done. To do that in the old days of what we called long wave technology, you'd have to either do ship to ship, island to island. It would take 4, 5, 6 hours to get a signal, let's say, across to San Francisco. This was one signal, straight across, clear. You can actually talk, no Morse code here. So that is really wireless technology that we take for granted today. The ability to talk begins with the Kaimaloa.
Where's the ship today?
The ship, interestingly enough, was said to have been downed in a typhoon of 1937. And in three cases, that's what we see, but we can't find any corroborating evidence. What we found out was that a British guy had bought the ship and changed the name of it to the Shenandoah 3. And this brings up another thing. There are still parts of this book that are still being researched. In fact, there is a 1 1/3 book. So this is the second book, volume 2. The first one's about the creation of how the Kaimaloa and his early lives. And this third book is about what happens after he steps onto Tahitian soil. A lot of things happening. He fires all the scientists. He buys 3,000 acres of land in Tahiti. And very soon after the second voyage, he gets divorced by wife number 2. So there's a lot of trauma. And when you have some of those things, you have to really focus on getting it right. So It's going to take a little longer to do volume 1 and volume 3. But this is volume 2 for the centennial of the first voyage.
You were talking about the ship being renamed, and that made me think about the name of the ship, because initially, just looking at it, I saw what looked like Kai meaning ocean, but that's not the etymology. It's Kaimiloa,
Kaimiloa, I believe. Which means the long search. Yes. Well, they're actually, in my book, I actually target 3 different versions of what it would mean. And I actually talked to the experts and linguists at the University of Hawaii the last time I was here. In general, it's the long search, which is to go far to seek knowledge. And it's not the first Kaimaloa. The first Kaimaloa, as you probably know, if you go on the internet and breathe Kaimaloa, you'll find the only sole naval warship that the Kingdom of Hawaii had. The king was very particular. Everybody had to play an instrument on board. He was more interested in pomp and circumstance. But that's the first Kaimaloa. And there's been many others after our Kaimaloa. The long search, basically.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about what the research process has been like for you. So you've been on island for a research trip before. Now you're back. It seems like a lot of archives, interviews, what sorts of things
still
were involved?
Going on, in fact. I just came from Auckland, New Zealand, where we found no less than 120 different articles in the Auckland papers. One of the surprising things was Kaimiloa hits a rock. We didn't know that it had to be sent to Sydney for repairs, which makes now understandable why they spent so much time in New Zealand. So that was a new thing. So there's still things that are still being looked at. And I'm still really always in the research phase. You know, when a book is done, especially a nonfiction, it's like, this is what we know right now, because there will always be something new on the horizon. But this is the story simply of the 2-month voyage one way to Tahiti. And luckily, there are about 3 different diaries, one from Kenneth Emery, the predominant ethnologist at the Bishop and even in the Pacific culture, Lilliam Wilder, who's one of the wives of horticulturists, and different things like that.
I want to get back to the Bishop scientists and what they were looking for. So, and maybe that's a different question even from what they found, but what were the sorts of questions that they were asking on this voyage?
You are onto something, because there was a lot of newspaper coverage on what was going to be. But in effect, they did incredible work, but it would take many more years to understand all this. But I will say this, the Kaimiloa represented one of the first expeditions that the Bishop Museum had such luxurious or just well-funded lab and space. You know, before then, a museum like the Bishop was at the mercy of, like, let's say a naval cutter, et cetera. And their scientists would complain. They'd be like kind of stuck in a room there, and it wasn't their call to where to, they just have to get, kind of run with it. But in this case, they had luxurious accommodations, an incredible lab, the ability to hold specimens and print pieces and moving film, et cetera.
How did the scientists get back from Tahiti once they'd been fired?
Kellum had some interesting issues with people sometimes. For example, Dr. Ball, the head of the expedition, didn't drink, didn't curse. And this is a problem with Mr. Kellum. So, I mean, this is what we're getting through some different diaries, etc. But I think that he didn't really realize how much it was going to impact where he wanted to go. But I do want to say, to his credit, Mr. Kellum wrote a $1,500 check. Now, that doesn't seem like a lot today. But in 1924, it allowed 2 of the scientists to go off for another 2 years on other smaller boats. So he still, you know, kept up his promise to support. But no, they all had to find their ways back to Honolulu, but not on his ship.
What are some of the things that have really, like, stuck with you or dragged you into this story?
I think the notion of exploration. There are still places in the world that are very remote. So in a way, it's like the deeper version of what is an epic journey. And these scientists were, even though the ship had all of the trimmings, it was still throwing yourself out there. You know, you didn't have the issue of having the weather forecasting. They were out there. Once they left Hawaii, anything could have happened. And they had very scant information, by the way. The scientists prepared themselves, and they were preparing themselves with notes that sometimes the cited source of a name of an island was like a 12-year-old boy on a ship. Back then, they were still in 1924, still discovering. So there was still that sense of this is new territory to explore and discover and collect. They collected everything from birds to fish to shells, photographs, of course, sounds, etc. So it was quite an expedition.
Yeah, I feel a lot of tension with the terms discovery and exploration, especially when we're talking about, like,
so
indigenous
right,
peoples
You're
of
so
different
right.
places. And so how do you reconcile kind of the excitement of discovery with the knowledge that
I want to apologize. Yeah. These places have been already lived in, discovered by, you know, generations way before it. So I'll be honest, the report that was written about the journey didn't happen till 10 years after this journey. So that'll be my third book. And I do have to dig into, you know, what was the final findings of all this. I've peeked into those, and there's a lot of moments where they were puzzled quizzically about what they were seeing, etc. And sometimes it would take many years to understand what they had seen at that moment.
And so your own journey, now talking about the second volume of this project, has taken you a bunch of places. You've been in Honolulu the past few days. You're going to Big Island in a little bit. What was the thinking of these presentations of wanting to go to Hawaii and present some of this information?
I've always been drawn to anniversaries. Even if nothing is at a particular place. If something happened there 100 years ago and I can get out there, there's something about being there so I can kind of take the pulse of the moment. So coming to Hawaii, one of the things I've been watching is what you see today as opposed to what you saw in 1924. And I am researching everything that's happening in Honolulu in 24 and noticing today what's there. It's just important for me to be there, to infuse it into there. And I've been places around the world and other projects where they're like, what are you doing here? There's nothing left here of that. It doesn't matter. There's something about, as a historian, right, I have to feel it. And I can't always tell you at the very moment what it is, but I'm taking mental notes and it'll definitely seep itself. I am going later today to the very Pier 10 that the Kaimaloa took off from. It's still there. It's still intact. That corner is, the building is the same building. The lighthouse, the ornamental lighthouse there was probably under construction because it was finished in 1925. I'll have to check on that. And there's probably a photo of, you know, with the construction. So yeah, things like that. And I kind of want to paint a picture on what has changed and what hasn't.
Yeah, and so interesting to be in that place to look and think to yourself, is this what someone 100 years ago would have seen? In what ways is it the same? In what ways is it different?
I mean, last night I saw a little boat come in from a sunset cruise, a dinner cruise. Probably at that time, very few boats other than the Kaimaloa could go off on a very luxurious dinner cruise of its time. Certainly no well-oiled, you know, tourism market to take out. So at the time, you know, the Kaimaloa would have been singular in that sense. And they did host a lot of parties before the send-off, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I was noticing that, actually. Like, oh, that ship kind of reminds me of what would have been back 100 years ago.
I mean, one thing that I'm thinking of when you mentioned how the communications aboard that ship would have been cutting-edge, state-of-the-art, now something that is coming onto both ships and also airplanes is like Starlink, satellite communication, and that is revolutionizing the field in a whole new way.
Absolutely. So. I actually do some of my interviews. I work in the cruise line industry. I lecture on board ships and I do a lot of class. I teach classes on board a ship. I do interviews on board a ship. But at the time, this would have been the Starlink of that moment. It was really impressive. In fact, when the first signal was sent out, the New York Times did a story about the testing of this radio just to get it right.
Approximately, when do you think the third volume is?
Well, I think I'll next work on volume one, which is the pre-story that includes the adapting of the ship from the Luzon to the technological wonder in his early days. That I think anywhere from 3 to 5 years from now due to the other projects I'm after. This took about 2 years, but we're only talking about a 2-month window. Just the way I write. Normally my books take years, sometimes 15 years. So this is lightning fast for me. But with the centennial, I really wanted it to come out this year.
But you're talking about like a multi-year long commitment.
Yeah.
You must really. Is there any point where you're like, oh gosh, I wish I wrote about something else? Or you wake up every day happy to be exploring?
It is a definite tug and pull, Maddie. I will be honest. I'm in it now so deep that I'm gotten into all of their minds and worlds. And there is a moment where a writer takes, it's probably in the middle of the project, where you're like, you're so deep, you're thinking, is it just me that finds this interesting? Is anybody really gonna care? And you have to really have a true faith that what you're doing is new and important. And I do feel that the Kaimaloa, it's been 100 years, and no one seminal work has been done on this particular journey.
Is there anything else you wanted to add or anything you want to leave listeners with?
I mean, if they want to get a copy of the book, they just go to SideshowCharlie.com and they can find a copy there.
That was historian Cesar Becerra talking with HBR's Maddie Bender. Becerra was on Oahu earlier this week, and he's currently in Hilo as part of a worldwide speaking tour about the Kaimaloa. He'll be at Basically Books tomorrow at 4 p.m. We'll have a link to more information on the conversation page of our website later today.
Thank you. When you support HPR, you support storytelling that illuminates understanding.
Our obligation was to each other, and the unwritten rule was this. We all come back or nobody comes back.
My son was in the Air Force, and he's a wounded warrior. He was severely injured in Afghanistan at just the precious age of his early 20s.
We hear stories that remind us of our humanity.
This was something that happened, as they say, a normal reaction to abnormal circumstances.
My service in combat, my service in Vietnam, probably is the singular most event or experience that I had that put me on a path to where I am today.
Help HPR uplift more community voices. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
You know, this weekend marks King Kalakaua's birthday. Iolani Palace is all decked out with colorful bunting and several banners in celebration of the occasion. On Saturday, which is his actual birth date, admission will be free for Kama'aina, with entertainment by the Royal Hawaiian Band and a review by the King's Color Guard. There's also a 150th Jubilee auction online underway. It's a fundraiser for the historic property that ends on Sunday. Today, in A Nod to the King, we bring you an interview with historian Ron Williams, Jr. He published an article recently about King David Kalakaua's last visit to Southern California, specifically his trip to San Diego.
So I'm a baseball fan, and I was and I'm a big San Diego fan. So I went with a friend down to see a Padres game. There's a new stadium there. It's beautiful, and it's on the water. And while I was there, I had known that there was a Hawaiian Kingdom consulate located in San Diego during the Hawaiian Kingdom period. There were actually about 136 Hawaiian Kingdom consulates around the world. And one of them in 1890 was founded in San Diego. So this was representation of the Hawaiian Kingdom in San Diego to protect Hawaiian Kingdom subjects when they came there, but also to push trade and things like that. And so I knew that. And so while I was there, I went into the Historical Center. There's a San Diego Historical Center, and looked at old fire maps. Those are the fire insurance maps that map out every building in town. And I found the ones from 1890, and on there was the Hawaiian Kingdom Consulate. So we were able to find out where that site is, locate it, my friend and I, and kind of claim that site again. A real quick funny story, we decided that we wanted to make people aware that this is the site. Today it's a fancy credit union. And I think the time has passed enough where I can tell the story. But my friend and I went to this grocery store and bought some sidewalk chalk. And we decided we were going to claim the space. And so I said, you draw a flag and I'll draw Hawaiian Kingdom Council 1890 to whatever on the wall. And I said, if somebody comes at us, you know, run. and so we did. And we were doing it. And somebody wasn't too happy and went in and told the guard. And the guard came out and chased us around San Diego for about 15 minutes. And I, you know,
hoodlums.
Right. And I was like, it's just sidewalk chalk. And also, I'm like, you know, he caught up with us about a mile away. And I said, dude, somebody's robbing your credit union right now. But anyway, so in that story I tell because this past year on La Ho'ihoi'ea, a native Hawaiian who's living in San Diego, I guess had seen my posts about that from a few years back. He went and with a Hawaiian Kingdom flag, Hai Hawaii, and sang Hawaii Pono'i at that site for 3 or 4 hours, you know, telling people this is the consulate. So, and it decided maybe he's going to start an anniversary where they do something. So those kind of things are important to do.
Yeah. Wow, the little flash mob thing.
Yeah.
You never know, right? It's a moolah.
Right.
Yeah. So you just recently published an article about the King's history down there in that area. And I just knew that he had stayed at the Coronado Hotel, right?
Right.
This really posh place. And I would love to visit, but you have. You have gone there.
Yeah. I had known that he died in San Francisco, like everyone basically knows. I had no idea he had also been to San Diego. And that's because his death in San Francisco kind of covered up everything. You know, that's the big event, and everyone thinks about it. But while he was there, he took a train ride to San Diego. And the purpose of the visit to San Diego was like many of his travels, and that was to investigate the most modern technology, to investigate the possibility of, you know, forming trade alliances, all these types of things that were his responsibility as Mo'i, as king. When he arrives in San Diego, there's a huge crowd waiting for him. Word had gotten out that he was coming, this native king who can trace his genealogy back to the beginning of time. And he's a very handsome man, very astute. So when he comes, the people welcome him, and he immediately gets taken by the mayor to the Coronado Hotel, you know, most expansive, you know, beautiful hotel in the world at that time. And also, it was built by Klaus Spreckels' brother. So the Spreckels connection that Kalakaua had allowed him to be there also. So he took a room in the hotel, and he kept a diary. But the most important resource that I was able to access to tell this story were those consulate letters. There's dozens and dozens of letters from the Hawaiian Kingdom Council in San Diego to Queen Liliuokalani and others back here in Hawaii, including one that talks about his death and so forth and offers their condolences and so forth. Hawaiian Kingdom Councilists around the world were not usually Native Hawaiian. They were usually local businessmen in those cities who could possibly help and so forth. And that was true in this case. While he was there, he was feted with all kinds of dinners, with invitations, and he accepted them all. It's important to understand he had gone there quite ill. He was sick, and his doctors recommended better air in San Diego. So he goes, and he's kind of sick, but he keeps this schedule that's really, really demanding. The naval officer, the U.S. naval officer, Blow was his name, who was accompanying Kalakaua, said every morning about 8 o'clock, Kalakaua had him come to his room, and they would lay out maps and discuss trade and discuss shipping and these types of issues. While he was there, he went and visited the Sweetwater Dam. The Sweetwater Dam is what at the time was the most technologically advanced dam in the world. It's what brought water to San Diego and turned this desert place into a green, you know, city. And so he visited Sweetwater Dam. The Native Hawaiian language newspapers back in Honolulu report that and follow his travels, and people are amazed, you know, this dam holds 6 billion gallons of water and so forth. He visits olive orchards. He thinks maybe olives will grow well in Hawaii and it'll get small farmers going and so forth. He's taken to the county chamber of commerce where they talk about the possibility of trade. There's actually, back in Hawaii, one of the legislators named Joseph Navahi, he proposes a bill to start a shipping line that goes from Hilo to San Diego. And he talks about the fact that this would help the Hilo farmers sell their produce in San Diego and so forth. And so there's all these kind of talks going on. There's these relationships being built by Kalakaua. He has a Mason dinner while he was there, because he was a Mason. And all of those types of things happen.
So I saw a letter that he penned talking about the rigorous schedule that he was on, and he was supposed to be there for rest.
Right. Yeah, his purpose for going was to rest, and he definitely didn't rest. And that's one of those narratives that is important to bring up, because we're pushing back against this old false narrative of the fact that he was the merry monarch, that all he did was basically drink and play poker and have fun. His gregariousness in San Diego is talked about constantly, but he was using that to build relationships, right? To remind people, especially at this time when the sovereignty of the kingdom was being threatened. You know, he was weakened under the bayonet constitution, and he's looking to move forward across the world and build those relationships so that if something does happen, maybe they'll back him up. Maybe they'll be there for him.
Refresh my memory. I'm trying to think. He basically said, yeah, I'm surprised I'm not half dead with the schedule that we're on.
Right.
You know?
Right.
One thing after another.
And also the U.S. officer also said that he didn't turn down any invitations, right? He goes out to, there's businessmen that he visits their homes. There's these different, he actually goes to the opera while he's in L.A. and all these different kind of events. And they're, again, to build those relationships, the mayor of L.A., the governor, and so forth. So he's looking to connect Hawaii and remind folks of Hawaii's sovereignty.
Initially, there was lots going on with gold.
Right. The gold rush. Well, the initial gold rush in 1849-50 in San Francisco drew lots of Native Hawaiian sailors and others, you know, to try to make a fortune. And so you see many people, many young Native Hawaiian men leaving Hawaii to go to California to kind of find their fortune. There was gold later discovered in Southern California, and that again kind of brought that attention to the people in Hawaii and elsewhere. And it became an issue. The kingdom actually started to say that you cannot leave Hawaiian Kingdom without a passport. And so they were letting folks go and not letting folks go and so forth. So it was a big issue, the discovery of gold in California. There's a book written that talks about the fact that by the 1820s and 30s, there were already camps of Native Hawaiians in the coast of Southern California. They were setting up, selling pelts and things like that, and creating a kind of a trade little city of Native Hawaiians there by the 1830s. That increases through the gold rush and so forth, and there ends up being a significant community. Now, the issue that becomes interesting, about this trip was that while he was there, the different sides, the U.S. newspapers, the Hawaiian newspapers, the U.S. military, the Hawaiian military, all of the sides agree about how well he was received. They talk about everyone, again, loved him. He was gregarious and so forth. The Hawaiian Kingdom Council for San Diego, Gervin, had to take an oath of allegiance to the kingdom and pledge his allegiance to become that minister. So he actually has an oath of allegiance to the Kingdom of Hawaii. When the overthrow happens in 1893, it doesn't take days, maybe weeks, before Gervin has pledged his allegiance to annexation, to pushing the idea of annexation of Hawaii to the United States. And this was contrary to everything that Kalakaua and then later his sister, Liliuokalani, was pushing for, and the will of the nation. And so I found that interesting that he was a representative of the Hawaiian Kingdom, had taken an oath to the Hawaiian Kingdom, and yet truly he had no allegiance to the kingdom.
Wow, I mean, so it just gives you a different dimension of the dynamics of that time, the politics.
Right, right, yeah. And he actually pushed, he gave speeches for annexation, but the Chamber of Commerce that had earlier feted Kalakaua and just praised him to no end, they drafted a resolution supporting the idea of annexation to the United States and sent it to Congress. When Kalakaua, almost every morning, so he had late nights and then he would go to sleep, almost every morning he would wander down to the main room of the hotel and see people passing by and say hi to them. And they would come over and he would invite them to dinner and so forth. And on the trip out to the dam, he actually taught the guests that was with him some Hawaiian songs, and he was singing Hawaiian songs. So again, that is his nature, this being joyful and gregarious and so forth. But when you look at the record and you start to uncover the record, you really understand how purposeful that is and how, again, he was building those relationships.
And you're big on original source material.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you know, we that's the thing about this, not only this story, there's so many stories that many of us are now telling that are accessing primary source material, often in Hawaiian language, that hasn't been accessed before. There's this whole revolution going on in Hawaiian history of listening to Native Hawaiians. Imagine that. And so a million pages of Hawaiian language newspaper, tens of thousands of documents in the archives in Hawaiian. So now we're being able to not just accept those stories about these Hawaiians, but actually listen to Hawaiians about Hawaiians.
By and about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything else that you want to share just about maybe his time in San Francisco? I don't know.
Yeah, so he leaves San Diego January 1st, 1891, and he's traveling back to San Francisco. And on the way there, he has a stroke. He has a small stroke because of his schedule and because he had been sick before he left and so forth. And he talks about that quite a bit in his letters. But he pushes on, and he arrives in San Francisco and actually passes. He dies at the Palace Hotel on January 20th, 1891. At that time, the governor of California contacted the military, and the president ordered a state funeral for Kalakaua. So among the many achievements of Kalakaua's first, you know, Kalakaua was the first guest of honor at a White House state dinner in 1874. He was the first monarch to travel the globe, to circumnavigate the globe. He was the first monarch to have electricity in their state, in their kingdom state house. So all of these firsts that he accomplished kind of gave him that prominence. And so when he died, he was given a funeral, a state funeral by the U.S., and there were 10,000 people that came out. They closed the stores, they closed the government offices, and they brought his body from the church down to the ship, the USS Charleston, which was the most up-to-date ship of that time. And the Charleston brought his body back to Hawaii. The story is kind of famous about Liliuokalani seeing the flag at half-mast, because there was no Twitter at the time, right? So she doesn't know what's happened. So when the ship carrying his body back into the bay, in harbor, Honolulu Harbor, arrives, then she finds out that he's passed. The interesting thing about that is about a year and a half later, when the Charleston is back visiting Honolulu again, the Queen produces a thank you letter, basically, to the officers of the ship for taking care of him and bringing him back in such a good manner. And she offers them royal orders, actually. They're not able to accept because of diplomatic things, but she really goes out of her way to thank those gentlemen for respecting him and bringing his body back to Hawaii.
Little details, which certainly gives you a glimpse, right, into what was happening with, right, the ali'i at that time.
And I think that, you know, one of the avenues of this article, one of the angles of the article, is the idea that here's these two port cities, these Pacific port cities that are connected. But that's just one of them, right? I remember that I had mentioned there was 136 consulates on six continents. So Hawaii had these relationships built around the world. There was a consulate in Port Townsend near Seattle, Washington. You know, I always try to make the point to people that these consulates weren't just for show. He didn't just build as many as he could. They were literally doing things that were crucial to the Hawaiian Kingdom. When that consulate in Port Townsend, Washington Territory, there was a time when Native Hawaiian sailors had gotten off a ship and not been paid by their captain. And he said, he just said, I'm not going to pay them. You know, what are they going to do? Well, they went to the Hawaiian Kingdom Consulate in Port Townsend and complained. The consulate contacted the Supreme Court, and they got their pay. So this protection of Native Hawaiians in San Diego, in Port Townsend, and around the world is something that Kalakaua accomplished.
Right. So there are all these documents associated with those consulates, and so there's lots of stories to be uncovered yet.
Yeah. There's hundreds of boxes up in the archives, in the Hawaii State Archives, that are from those consulates. Yeah. So exciting times.
So you haven't been through them all yet?
Not yet.
Oh, and we can't wait till he does. That was historian Ron Williams Jr. sharing stories about King David Kalakaua's last visit to San Diego. It's research based on documents from the State Archives where he works. And, you know, we will have a link to the article in the Journal of San Diego History on our website later today. And check out the Iolani Palace events this weekend as we mark Kalakaua's birthday.
Kalakaua, Pegioa, kapua mai ole I kala.
Well, that does it for us for this hour. Tomorrow, we plan to travel to the Garden Isle. Join us as we talk to Mayor Derek Kawakami and explore what Kauai has to offer. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or check on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.